if intensive blood glucose management was beneficial in treating type 2 diabetes, but there were many separate sub-studies within this study. Once again, two similar groups received standard versus intensive treatment. Within the intensive group, patients were given one of two treatments, either insulin injections or a sulfonylurea drug, which increases the body's own insulin secretion. Both treatments will increase insulin levels, although by different mechanisms. Insulin injections will raise serum levels higher than the sulfonylurea. What happened to the participants' weight? The intensive group gained an average of about 6.8 pounds, 3.1 kilograms. Those that were treated with insulin gained even more, about 9 pounds, 4 kilograms on average. Increased insulin levels, whether by direct insulin injection or the use of sulfonylurea, caused significant weight gain. Once again, insulin levels were increased. Patients gained weight. Newer types of long-acting insulin produced weight gain too. A 2007 study compared three different insulin protocols. What happened to the participants' weight? The study noted, patients generally gained weight on all regimens. Participants in the basal insulin group, which received the lowest average insulin dose, gained the least average amount of weight, 4.2 pounds, 1.9 kilograms. Those in the prandial insulin group, which received the most insulin, gained the most weight, 12.5 pounds, 5.7 kilograms on average. The intermediate group gained an average 10.3 pounds, 4.7 kilograms. The more insulin doctors gave, the more weight participants gained. And reducing caloric intake proved useless. In a fascinating 1993 study, high-dose insulin allowed virtual normalization of blood sugars in a group of type 2 diabetic patients. Starting from zero, the dose was increased to an average of 100 units per day over a period of 6 months. At the same time, patients decreased their caloric intake by more than 300 calories per day. The patients' blood sugar levels were great, but what happened to their weight? It increased by an average of 19 pounds, 8.7 kilograms. Despite eating less than ever, patients gained weight like crazy. It wasn't calories that drove their weight gain, it was insulin. Insulin also causes weight gain in non-diabetics. Consider what happens to patients with insulinomas, very rare insulin-secreting tumors usually found in non-diabetics. The estimated incidence is only 4 cases per million per year. This tumor constantly secretes very large amounts of insulin, causing recurrent episodes of hypoglycemia, low blood sugar. But what happens to body weight? A prospective case series showed that weight gain occurs in 72% of patients. Removal of the tumor resulted in cure in 24 out of 25 cases. Removal of malignant insulinoma led to rapid and sustained weight loss. A 2005 case study describes a 20-year-old woman diagnosed with insulinoma. She had gained 25 pounds over the year prior to her diagnosis. Increased caloric intake did not account for the weight gain. Reduced caloric intake did not account for the weight loss. The defining element was insulin. Its rise and fall corresponded to the rise and fall in weight. Oral hypoglycemic agents. We've seen that injections of insulin manufactured outside the body cause weight gain. There are, however, other medications called oral hypoglycemic agents that are taken by mouth and cause the body to produce more insulin. If these drugs also cause obesity, then that is extremely strong evidence of the causal link between insulin and weight gain. Sulfonylureas and metformin. Several pills are available for the drug treatment of type 2 diabetes. The sulfonylurea class work by stimulating the pancreas to produce more insulin to lower blood sugars. All drugs in this class are well known to cause weight gain. Another oral hypoglycemic agent is metformin. Metformin decreases the amount of glucose produced by the liver and increases glucose uptake by the muscles. Insulin, the sulfonylureas, and metformin all have different effects on insulin levels. Insulin raises blood insulin levels the most. The sulfonylurea drug class also raises insulin levels, but not as much as insulin, and metformin does not increase insulin at all. These three treatments were compared against each other in another study. There was no difference in blood sugar control between the metformin group and the sulfonylurea group. But what are the effects of the different treatments on weight? Participants in the insulin group experienced the most weight gain, more than 10 pounds, 4.5 kilograms on average. We raised insulin. Patients gained weight. Participants in the sulfonylurea group also gained weight, about 6 pounds, 2.5 kilograms on average. We raised insulin a little, patients gained a little weight. Patients in the metformin group did not gain any more weight than those on diet alone. We didn't raise insulin, patients didn't gain weight. Insulin causes weight gain. Thiazolidinediones. The thiazolidinediones class of medications works by increasing insulin sensitivity. Thiazolidinediones do not raise insulin levels. Instead, they magnify the effect of insulin, and as a result, blood sugars are lowered. Thiazolidinediones enjoyed tremendous popularity after their launch, but because of safety concerns about two of these drugs, rosiglitazone and pioglitazone, they are now rarely used. These drugs showed a major effect other than their blood sugar-lowering ability. By amplifying insulin's effect, this insulin sensitizer caused weight gain. Incretin agents. Incretin hormones are secreted in the stomach in response to food. These hormones may slow down stomach emptying, leading to the side effect of nausea and also cause a short-term increase in insulin release, but only in association with meals. Several drugs that increase the effect of incretins have been tested and in general are found to cause mild weight gain at worst, although study results vary. Certain incretin agents at higher doses promote weight loss, likely related to the slowing of the stomach emptying. We didn't raise insulin on a sustained basis. Weight was not gained. Incretin agents will be discussed in much greater detail in Chapter 17. Alpha-glucosidase inhibitors. The alpha-glucosidase inhibitor class of medication blocks enzymes in the small intestine that help to digest carbohydrates. As a result, the body absorbs less glucose and has lower blood glucose levels. Neither glucose use nor insulin secretion is affected. The decrease in absorbed glucose causes a small decrease in the patient's insulin levels. And what about weight? Patients had a small but statistically significant weight loss. We lowered insulin a little. Patients lost a little weight. SGLT2 inhibitors. The newest class of medication for type 2 diabetes is the SGLT2 sodium glucose-linked transporter inhibitors. These drugs block the reabsorption of glucose by the kidney so that it spills out in the urine. This lowers blood sugars, resulting in less insulin production. SGLT2 inhibitors can lower glucose and insulin levels after a meal by as much as 35% and 43%, respectively. But what effect do SGLT2 inhibitors have on weight? Studies consistently show a sustained and significant weight loss in patients taking these drugs. Unlike virtually all dietary studies that show an initial weight loss followed by weight regain, this study found that the weight loss experienced by patients on SGLT2 inhibitors continued for 1 year and longer. Furthermore, their weight loss was predominantly loss of fat rather than lean muscle, although it was generally modest, around 2.5% of body weight. We lowered insulin, patients lost weight. Non-diabetic medications. Certain medications unrelated to diabetes are also consistently related to weight gain and loss. A recent meta-analysis reviewed 257 randomized trials covering 54 different drugs to see which drugs are associated with weight change. The drug olanzapine, used to treat psychiatric disorders, is commonly associated with weight gain, 5.2 pounds, 2.4 kilograms on average. Does olanzapine raise insulin levels? Absolutely. Prospective studies confirm that it does. As insulin rises, so does weight. Gabapentin, a drug commonly used to treat nerve pain, is also associated with weight gain, averaging 4.8 pounds, 2.2 kilograms. Does it magnify insulin's effect? Absolutely. There are numerous reports of severe low blood sugars with this drug. It appears that gabapentin increases the body's own insulin production. Quetiapine is another antipsychotic medication associated with a smaller 2.4 pound, 1.1 kilogram average weight gain. Does it raise insulin levels? Absolutely. Insulin secretion as well as insulin resistance is increased after starting quetiapine. In all these cases, we increased insulin levels. People gained weight. I can make you thin. If insulin causes weight gain, can lowering its levels have the opposite effect? As insulin is reduced to very low levels, we should expect significant and severe weight loss. The SGLT2, sodium glucose-linked transporter inhibitors, which lower glucose and insulin, are an example of the effect that lowering insulin may have on weight, albeit in their case the effect is mild. Another more dramatic example is the untreated type 1 diabetic patient. Type 1 diabetes is an autoimmune disease that destroys the insulin-producing beta cells of the pancreas. Insulin falls to extremely low levels. Blood sugar increases, but the hallmark of this condition is severe weight loss. Type 1 diabetes has been described since ancient times. Aretaeus of Cappadocia, a renowned ancient Greek physician, wrote the classic description. Diabetes is a melting down of flesh and limbs into urine. No matter how many calories the patient ingests, he or she cannot gain any weight. Until the discovery of insulin, this disease was almost universally fatal. Insulin levels go way down. Patients lose a lot of weight. In the type 1 diabetic community, there is a disorder called diabulimia. Today, type 1 diabetic patients are treated by daily injections of insulin. There are some patients who wish to lose weight for cosmetic reasons. Diabulimia is the deliberate underdosing of insulin for the purpose of immediate and substantial weight loss. It is extremely dangerous and certainly not advisable. However, the practice persists because it is an extremely effective form of weight loss. Insulin levels go down, weight is lost. Mechanisms. The results are very consistent. Drugs that raise insulin levels cause weight gain. Drugs that have no effect on insulin levels are weight neutral. Drugs that lower insulin levels cause weight loss. The effect on weight is independent of the effect on blood sugar. A recent study suggests that 75% of the weight loss response in obesity is predicted by insulin levels, not willpower, not caloric intake, not peer support or peer pressure, not exercise, just insulin. Insulin causes obesity, which means that insulin must be one of the major controllers of the body's set weight. As insulin goes up, the body set weight goes up. the hypothalamus sends out hormonal signals to the body to gain weight. We become hungry and eat. If we deliberately restrict caloric intake, then our total energy expenditure will decrease. The result is still the same. Weight gain. As the insightful Gary Tobbs wrote in his book, Why We Get Fat and What to Do About It, we do not get fat because we overeat. We overeat because we get fat. And why do we get fat? We get fat because our body set weight thermostat is set too high. Why? Because our insulin levels are too high. Hormones are central to understanding obesity. Everything about human metabolism, including the body set weight, is hormonally regulated. A critical physiological variable such as body fatness is not left up to the vagaries of daily caloric intake and exercise. Instead, hormones precisely and tightly regulate body fat. We don't consciously control our body weight any more than we control our heart rates, our basal metabolic rates, our body temperatures, or our breathing. These are all automatically regulated, and so is our weight. Hormones tell us we are hungry, ghrelin. Hormones tell us we are full, peptide YY, cholecystokinin. Hormones increase energy expenditure, adrenaline. Hormones shut down energy expenditure, thyroid hormone. Obesity is a hormonal dysregulation of fat accumulation. Calories are nothing more than the proximate cause of obesity. Obesity is a hormonal, not a caloric imbalance. The question of how insulin causes weight gain is a much more complex problem, to which all the answers are not yet known. But there are many theories. Dr. Robert Lustig, a pediatric obesity specialist, believes that high insulin levels act as an inhibitor of leptin, the hormone that signals satiety. Leptin levels increase with body fat. This response acts on the hypothalamus in a negative feedback loop to decrease food intake and return the body to its ideal weight. However, because the brain becomes leptin resistant due to constant exposure, it does not reduce its signal to gain fat. In many ways, insulin and leptin are opposites. Insulin promotes fat storage. Leptin reduces fat storage. High levels of insulin should naturally act as an antagonist to leptin. However, the precise mechanisms by which insulin inhibits leptin are yet unknown. Both fasting insulin and fasting leptin levels are higher in obese people, indicating a state of both insulin and leptin resistance. The leptin response to a meal was also different. In lean people, leptin levels rose, which makes sense, as leptin is a satiety hormone. However, in obese subjects, leptin levels fell. Despite the meal, their brains were not getting the message to stop eating. The leptin levels resistance seen in obesity may also develop due to self-regulation. Persistently high leptin levels lead to leptin resistance. It is also possible that high insulin levels may cause increased weight gain by mechanisms unrelated to leptin in pathways yet to be discovered. The crucial point to understand, however, is not how insulin causes obesity, but that insulin does, in fact, cause obesity. Once we understand that obesity is a hormonal imbalance, we can begin to treat it. If we believe that excess calories cause obesity, then the treatment is to reduce calories. But this method has been a complete failure. However, if too much insulin causes obesity, then it becomes clear we need to lower insulin levels. The question is not how to balance calories. The question is how to balance our hormones. The most crucial question in obesity is how to reduce insulin. Chapter 8. Cortisol. I can make you fat. Actually, I can make anybody fat. How? I prescribe prednisone, a synthetic version of the human hormone cortisol. Prednisone is used to treat many diseases, including asthma, rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, psoriasis, inflammatory bowel disease, cancer, glomerulonephritis, and myasthenia gravis. And what is one of the most consistent effects of prednisone? Like insulin, it makes you fat. Not coincidentally, both insulin and cortisol play a key role in carbohydrate metabolism. Prolonged cortisol stimulation will raise glucose levels and, subsequently, insulin. This increase in insulin plays a substantial role in the resulting weight gain. The stress hormone. Cortisol is the so-called stress hormone, which mediates the fight-or-flight response, a set of physiological responses to perceived threats. Cortisol, part of a class of steroid hormones called glucocorticoids, glucose plus cortex plus steroid, is produced in the adrenal cortex. In Paleolithic times, the stress that led to a release of cortisol was often physical. For instance, being chased by a predator. Cortisol is essential in preparing our bodies for action, to fight or flee. Once released, cortisol substantially enhances glucose availability, which provides energy for muscles, very necessary in helping us to run and avoid being eaten. All available energy is directed towards surviving the stressful event. Growth, digestion, and other long-term metabolic activities are temporarily restricted. Proteins are broken down and converted to glucose, gluconeogenesis. Vigorous physical exertion, fight or flight, soon often followed, burning up these newly available stores of glucose. Shortly thereafter, we were either dead or the danger was past and our cortisol decreased back to its normal low levels. And that's the point. The body is well adapted to a short-term increase in cortisol and glucose levels. Over the long term, however, a problem arises. Cortisol raises insulin. At first glance, cortisol and insulin appear to have opposite effects. Insulin is a storage hormone. Under high insulin levels, mealtimes, the body stores energy in the form of glycogen and fat. Cortisol, however, prepares the body for action, moving energy out of stores and into readily available forms, such as glucose. That cortisol and insulin would have similar weight gain effects seems remarkable, but they do. With short-term physical stress, insulin and cortisol play opposite roles. Something quite different happens, though, when we're under long-term psychological stress. In our modern-day lives, we have many chronic, non-physical stressors that increase our cortisol levels. For example, marital issues, problems at work, arguments with children, and sleep deprivation are all serious stressors, but they do not result in the vigorous physical exertion needed to burn off the blood glucose. Under conditions of chronic stress, glucose levels remain high, and there is no resolution to the stressor. Our blood glucose can remain elevated for months, triggering the release of insulin. Chronically elevated cortisol leads to increased insulin levels, as demonstrated by several studies. One 1998 study showed that cortisol levels increased with self-perceived stress levels, strongly linked to increased levels of both glucose and insulin. Since insulin is the major driver of obesity, it should be no surprise that both body mass index and abdominal obesity increased. Using synthetic cortisol, we can increase insulin experimentally. Healthy volunteers given high-dose cortisol increased their insulin levels 36% above their baseline. Prednisone increases glucose levels by 6.5% and insulin levels by 20%. Over time, insulin resistance, that is, impairment of the body's ability to process insulin, also develops, mainly in the liver and skeletal muscle. There is a direct dose-response relationship between cortisol and insulin. Long-term use of prednisone leads to an insulin-resistant state in a patient, or even to full-blown diabetes. This increased insulin resistance leads back to elevated insulin levels. Glucocorticoids cause muscle breakdown, releasing amino acids for gluconeogenesis, increasing blood sugars. Adiponectin, secreted by fat cells, which normally increase insulin sensitivity, are suppressed by glucocorticoids. In a sense, insulin resistance should be expected since cortisol generally opposes insulin. Cortisol raises blood sugar, while insulin lowers it. Insulin resistance, discussed in depth in Chapter 10, is crucial to the development of obesity. Insulin resistance leads directly to higher insulin levels, and increased insulin levels are a major driver of obesity. Multiple studies confirm that increasing cortisol increases insulin resistance. If increasing cortisol raises insulin, then reducing cortisol should lower it. We find this effect in transplant patients who take prednisone, the synthetic cortisol, for years or decades as part of their anti-rejection medication. According to one study, weaning them off prednisone resulted in a 25% drop in plasma insulin, which translated to a 6% weight loss and a 7.7% decrease in waist girth. Cortisol and obesity. Here's the real question we are interested in. Does excess cortisol lead to weight gain? The ultimate test is this. Can I make somebody fat with prednisone? If so, that can prove a causal relationship rather than a mere association. So, does prednisone cause obesity? Absolutely. Weight gain is one of prednisone's most common, well-known, and dreaded side effects. This relationship is causal. It is helpful to look at what happens to people with certain diseases, particularly Cushing's disease or Cushing's syndrome, which is characterized by long-term excessive cortisol production. Cushing's disease is named for Harvey Cushing, who in 1912 described a 23-year-old woman suffering from weight gain, excessive hair growth, and loss of menstruation. In up to one-third of Cushing's cases, high blood sugars and overt diabetes are also present. But the hallmark of Cushing's syndrome, even in people with mild forms, is weight gain. In one case series, 97% of patients show abdominal weight gain and 94% show increased body weight. Patients gain weight no matter how little they eat and no matter how much they exercise. Any disease that causes excess cortisol secretion results in weight gain. Cortisol causes weight gain. However, there's evidence of the association between cortisol and weight gain even in people who don't have Cushing's syndrome. In a random sample from North Glasgow, Scotland, cortisol excretion rates were strongly correlated to body mass index and waist measurements. Higher cortisol levels were seen in heavier people. Cortisol-related weight gain, particularly abdominal fat deposits, results in an increased waist-to-hip ratio. This effect is significant because abdominal fat deposits are more dangerous to health than all-over weight gain. Other measures of cortisol confirm its association with abdominal obesity. People with higher urinary cortisol excretion have higher waist-to-hip ratios. People with higher cortisol in their saliva have increased body mass index and waist-to-hip ratio. Long-term exposure to cortisol in the body may also be measured by scalp hair analysis. In a study comparing obese patients to those of normal weight, researchers found elevated levels of cortisol in scalp hair of the obese patients. In other words, Substantial evidence indicates that chronic cortisol stimulation increases both insulin secretion and obesity. Therefore, the hormonal theory of obesity takes shape. Chronically high cortisol raises insulin levels, which in turn leads to obesity. What about the opposite? If high cortisol levels cause weight gain, then low cortisol levels should cause weight loss. This exact situation exists in the case of Addison's disease. Thomas Addison described this classic condition, also known as adrenal insufficiency, in 1855. Cortisol is produced in the adrenal gland. When the adrenal gland is damaged, cortisol levels in the body can drop very low. The hallmark of Addison's disease is weight loss. Up to 97% of patients exhibited weight loss. Cortisol levels went down, people lost weight. Cortisol may act through high insulin levels and insulin resistance, but there may also be other pathways of obesity yet to be discovered. However, the undeniable fact remains that excess cortisol causes weight gain. And so, by extension, stress causes weight gain, something that many people have intuitively understood, despite the lack of rigorous evidence. Stress contains neither calories nor carbohydrates, but can still lead to obesity. Long-term stress leads to long-term elevated cortisol levels, which leads to extra pounds. Reducing stress is difficult, but vitally important. Contrary to popular belief, sitting in front of the television or computer is a poor way to relieve stress. Instead, stress relief is an active process. There are many time-tested methods of stress relief, including mindfulness meditation, yoga, massage therapy, and exercise. Studies on mindfulness intervention found that participants were able to use yoga, guided meditations, and group discussion to successfully reduce cortisol and abdominal fat. For practical information on reducing stress through mindfulness meditation and improved sleep hygiene, refer to Appendix C. Sleep deprivation is a major cause of chronic stress today. Sleep duration has been steadily declining. In 1910, people slept 9 hours on average. However, recently, more than 30% of adults between 30 and 64 years of age report getting fewer than 6 hours of sleep per night. Shift workers are especially prone to sleep deprivation and often report fewer than 5 hours of sleep per night. Population studies consistently link short sleep duration and excess weight, generally with 7 hours being the point where weight gain starts. Sleeping 5 to 6 hours was associated with a more than 50% increased risk of weight gain. The more sleep deprivation, the more weight gained. Mechanisms. Sleep deprivation is a potent psychological stressor and thus stimulates cortisol. This, in turn, results in both high insulin levels and insulin resistance. A single night of sleep deprivation increases cortisol levels by more than 100%. By the next evening, cortisol is still 37% to 45% higher. Restriction of sleep to 4 hours in healthy volunteers resulted in a 40% decrease in insulin sensitivity, even after a single sleep-deprived night. After 5 days of sleep restriction, insulin secretion increased 20% and insulin sensitivity decreased by 25%. Cortisol increased by 20%. In another study, shortened sleep duration increased the risk of type 2 diabetes. Both leptin and ghrelin, key hormones in the control of body fatness and appetite, show a daily rhythm and are disrupted by sleep disturbance. Both the Wisconsin Sleep Cohort Study and the Quebec Family Study demonstrated that short sleep duration is associated with higher body weight, decreased leptin, and increased ghrelin. Sleep deprivation clearly will undermine weight loss efforts. Interestingly, sleep deprivation under low stress conditions does not decrease leptin or increase hunger, which suggests that it is not the sleep loss per se that is harmful, but the activation of the stress hormones and hunger mechanisms. Getting enough good sleep is essential to any weight loss plan. Chapter 9. The Atkins Onslaught. The Carbohydrate Insulin Hypothesis. As we've now established that insulin causes obesity, our next question is, what foods causes our insulin levels to rise or to spike? The most obvious candidate is the refined carbohydrate, highly refined grains and sugars. This brings us not to a new idea, but back to a very old idea that predates even William Banting, the idea that fattening carbohydrates caused obesity. Highly refined carbohydrates are the most notorious foods for raising blood sugars. High blood sugars lead to high insulin levels. High insulin levels lead to weight gain and obesity. This chain of causes and effects has become known as the carbohydrate insulin hypothesis. The man who found himself at the center of the controversy was the infamous Dr. Robert Atkins. In 1963, Dr. Robert Atkins was a fat man. Like William Banting 100 years before, he needed to do something. Weighing in at 224 pounds, 100 kilograms, he had recently begun his cardiology practice in New York City. He had tried the conventional ways to lose weight, but had met with no success. Recalling the medical literature published by doctors Pennington and Gordon on low-carbohydrate diets, he decided to try the low-carbohydrate approach himself. To his amazement, it worked as advertised. Without counting calories, he shed his bothersome extra weight. He started prescribing the low-carbohydrate diet to patients and had some notable success. In 1965, he appeared on The Tonight Show, and in 1970 was featured in Vogue. In 1972, he published his original book, Dr. Atkins' Diet Revolution. It was an immediate bestseller and one of the fastest-selling diet books in history. The Low-Carb Revolution. Dr. Atkins never claimed to have invented the low-carb diet. That approach had been around long before the formerly popular diet doctor wrote about it. Jean-Anthelme Brillat-Savarin wrote about carbohydrates and obesity in 1825. William Banting described the same relationship in his best-selling pamphlet, Letter on Corpulence, in 1863. These ideas have endured for close to two centuries. However, by the mid-1950s, the caloric reduction theory of obesity was gaining ascendancy. It seemed so much more scientific to be discussing calories rather than foods. But there were still holdouts. Dr. Alfred Pennington wrote an editorial in the New England Journal of Medicine in 1953, emphasizing the role of carbohydrates in obesity. Studies by Dr. Walter Bloom comparing low-carbohydrate diets to fasting regimens had found comparable weight loss between the two. Dr. Erwin Stillman wrote The Doctor's Quick Weight Loss Diet in 1967, recommending a high-protein, low-carbohydrate diet. It quickly sold more than 2.5 million copies. Since it takes extra energy to metabolize dietary protein, the thermogenic effect of food, eating more protein could theoretically cause more weight loss. Dr. Stillman himself lost 50 pounds following the Stillman diet, which contained up to 90% protein. He reportedly used the diet to treat more than 10,000 overweight patients. By the time Dr. Atkins joined the fray, the low-carbohydrate revolution was already well underway. Dr. Atkins argued in his 1972 bestseller that severely restricting carbohydrates would keep insulin levels low, thus reducing hunger and eventually leading to weight loss. It didn't take long for the nutritional authorities to respond. In 1973, the American Medical Association's Council on Foods and Nutrition published a blistering attack on Atkins' ideas. Most physicians at that time worried that the high fat content of the diet would lead to heart attacks and strokes. Nonetheless, low-carb proponents continued to preach. In 1983, Dr. Richard Bernstein, himself a type 1 diabetic since age 9, opened a controversial clinic to treat diabetics with a strict low-carbohydrate diet, a method that directly contradicted most nutritional and medical teachings of the time. In 1997, Bernstein published Dr. Bernstein's Diabetes Solution. In 1992, and then again in 1999, Atkins updated his bestseller with the publication of Dr. Atkins' New Diet Revolution. Bernstein's and Atkins' books would become monster bestsellers, with more than 10 million copies sold. In 1993, scientists Rachel and Richard Heller wrote The Carbohydrate Addict's Diet, which sold more than 6 million copies. The Atkins onslaught had well and truly begun. The low-carb diet's popularity, rekindled in the 1990s, ignited into a full-scale inferno in 2002, when award-winning journalist Gary Taubes wrote a controversial lead article in the New York Times entitled, "What If It's All Been a Big Fat Lie?" He argued that dietary fat, long believed to cause atherosclerosis, was actually quite harmless to human health. He followed that up with the best-selling books Good Calories, Bad Calories, and Why We Get Fat, in which he expounded on the idea that carbohydrates were the root cause of weight gain. The Empire Strikes Back. These ideas were slow to take hold in the medical community. Many physicians still felt that low carb was simply the latest in a long line of failed dietary fads. The American Heart Association, AHA, published its own book called The No-Fad Diet, A Personal Plan for Healthy Weight Loss. It's only mildly ironic that while condemning other diets, the AHA would recommend the only diet, low-fat, repeatedly proven to fail. But the low-fat religion was enshrined in the medical community, and it did not tolerate disbelievers. Despite a stunning lack of evidence to support this low-fat advice, medical associations such as the AHA and the American Medical Association were quick to defend their beliefs and denounce these new fad diets. But the Atkins onslaught was relentless. In 2004, more than 26 million Americans claimed to be on some type of low-carbohydrate diet. Even fast food chains introduced low-carb lettuce-wrapped burgers. The possibility of permanently reducing excess weight and all its associated health complications seemed within grasp. The AHA admitted that the reduced-fat diet was unproven over the long term. It also conceded that the Atkins diet evidenced a superior cholesterol profile and yielded a more rapid initial weight loss. Despite these benefits, the AHA maintained its concerns with atherogenicity, the rate at which plaques would form in the arteries. There was, of course, no evidence to support this concern. Regarding its own recommended but scientifically unsupported low-fat diet, the AHA had no concerns at all. No concern that higher intake of sugar and other refined carbohydrates could be harmful. No concern that the low-fat diet had been proved a spectacular failure by every dietary study done. No concern that the obesity and diabetes epidemics were raging full force under their very noses. The AHA fiddled while Rome burned. During the 40 years that the AHA advised the low-fat diet, the obesity crisis grew to gargantuan proportions. Yet at no time did the AHA question whether their completely ineffectual advice was actually helping people. Instead, doctors played their favorite game, blame the patient. "It is not our fault the diet doesn't work. It is their fault for not following the diet." Low-carb diets, a stunned medical community. As the new competitor challenged conventional dietary wisdom, the campaign of slurs and innuendo began. Nonetheless, new studies started appearing by the mid-2000s comparing the new low-carb diets to the old standards. The results would shock many, myself included. The first study, published in the prestigious New England Journal of Medicine in 2003, confirmed greater short-term weight loss with the Atkins diet. In 2007, the Journal of the American Medical Association published a more detailed study. Four different popular weight plans were compared in a head-to-head trial. One clear winner emerged, the Atkins diet. The other three diets, Ornish, which has very low fat, the Zone, which balances protein, carbohydrates, and fat in a 30-40-30 ratio, and a standard low-fat diet, were fairly similar with regard to weight loss. However, in comparing the Atkins to the Ornish, it became clear that not only was weight loss better, but so was the entire metabolic profile. Blood pressure, cholesterol, and blood sugars all improved to a greater extent on Dr. Atkins' diet. In 2008, the DIRECT Dietary Intervention Randomized Controlled Trial study reaffirmed once again the superior short-term weight reduction of the Atkins diet. Done in Israel, it compared the Mediterranean, the low-fat, and the Atkins diets. While the Mediterranean diet held its own against the powerful, fat-reducing Atkins diet, the low-fat AHA standard was left choking in the dust. Sad, tired, and unloved, except by academic physicians. More importantly, the metabolic benefits of both the Atkins and Mediterranean diets were confirmed. The Atkins diet reduced average blood sugar levels by 0.9%, far more than other diets, and almost as powerful as most medications. The high-protein, low-glycemic index diet maintained weight loss better than the low-fat diet over 6 months. Part of the reason may be that different weight loss diets provoke different changes in total energy expenditure. Dr. David Ludwig from Harvard University found that the low-fat diet slowed body metabolism the most. What was the best diet for maintaining metabolism? The very low-carbohydrate diet. This diet also seemed to reduce appetite. Dr. G. Bowden wrote in the Annals of Internal Medicine in 2005, "When we took away the carbohydrates, the patients spontaneously reduced their daily energy consumption by 1,000 calories a day. Insulin levels dropped and insulin sensitivity was restored." Perhaps eating refined carbohydrates leads to food addictions. Natural satiety signals are hormones that are extremely powerful deterrents to overeating. Hormones such as cholecystokinin and peptide YY respond to ingested proteins and fats to signal us to stop eating. Now, let's return to that all-you-can-eat buffet mentioned in Chapter 5. At some point, you simply cannot eat anymore, and the idea of consuming two more pork chops is sickening. That feeling is your satiety hormones telling you that you've had enough. But what if you were offered a small slice of cake or apple pie? It doesn't seem so hard to eat now, does it? As kids, we used to call this the second stomach phenomenon. After the first stomach for regular food was full, we imagined there was a second one for desserts. Somehow, despite being full, we still have room for highly refined carbohydrates like cake and pie, but not proteins or fats. Highly refined and processed foods somehow do not trigger the release of satiety hormones, and we go ahead and eat that cake. Think about foods that people say they're addicted to. Pasta, bread, cookies, chocolate, chips. Notice anything? All are highly refined carbohydrates. Does anybody ever say they are addicted to fish? Apples? Beef? Spinach? Not likely. Those are all delicious foods, but not addictive. Consider some typical comfort foods. Macaroni and cheese. Pasta. Ice cream. Apple pie. Mashed potatoes. Pancakes. Notice anything? All are highly refined carbohydrates. There is evidence that these foods activate the reward systems in our brains, which gives us comfort. Refined carbohydrates are easy to become addicted to and overeat precisely because there are no natural satiety hormones for refined carbs. The reason, of course, is that refined carbohydrates are not natural foods, but are instead highly processed. Their toxicity lies in that processing. The Atkins decline. The studies mentioned previously left the medical profession stunned and a little bit flabbergasted. Each had been undertaken almost with the express purpose of destroying the Atkins reputation. They came to bury the Atkins diet, but instead had crowned it. One by one, the concerns of the low-carb movement were put to rest. The new diet revolution was on pace. Long live the revolution! But trouble was on the horizon. Longer-term studies of the Atkins diet failed to confirm the much-hoped-for benefits. Dr. Gary Foster from Temple University published 2-year results showing that both the low-fat and the Atkins groups had lost but then regained weight at virtually the same rate. After 12 months, all the direct study patients, including the Atkins group, regained much of the weight they'd lost. A systematic review of all the dietary trials showed that much of the benefits of a low-carbohydrate approach evaporated after 1 year. Greater compliance was supposed to be one of the main benefits of the Atkins approach, since there was no need for calorie counting. However, following the severe food restrictions of Atkins proved no easier for dieters than conventional calorie counting. Compliance was equally low in both groups, with upwards of 40% abandoning the diet within 1 year. In hindsight, this outcome was somewhat predictable. The Atkins diet severely restricted highly indulgent foods such as cakes, cookies, ice cream, and other desserts. These foods are clearly fattening, no matter what diet you believe in. We continue to eat them simply because they are indulgent. Food is a celebration, and feasting has accompanied celebration throughout human history. This is as true in year 2015 AD as it was in year 2015 BC. Birthdays, weddings, and holiday celebrations. What do we eat? Cake, ice cream, pie. Not whey powder shakes and lean pork. Why? Because we want to indulge. The Atkins diet does not allow for this simple fact, and that doomed it to failure. The first-hand experience of many people confirmed that the Atkins diet was not a lasting one. Millions of people abandoned the Atkins approach, and the new diet revolution faded into just another dietary fad. The company Atkins Nutritionals, founded in 1989 by Dr. Atkins, filed for bankruptcy, having sustained heavy losses as its customers fled. The weight loss benefits could not be sustained. But why? What happened? One of the founding principles of the low-carbohydrate approach is that dietary carbohydrates increase blood sugars the most. High blood sugars lead to high insulin. High insulin is the key driver of obesity. Those facts seem reasonable enough. What was wrong? The carbohydrate-insulin hypothesis was incomplete. The carbohydrate-insulin hypothesis, the idea that carbohydrates cause weight gain because of insulin secretion, was not exactly wrong. Carbohydrate-rich foods certainly do increase insulin levels to a greater extent than the other macronutrients. High insulin certainly does lead to obesity. However, the hypothesis stands incomplete. There are many problems with the paradox of the Asian rice eater being the most obvious. Most Asians, for at least the last half century, ate a diet based on white, polished rice, a highly refined carbohydrate. Yet, until recently, obesity remained quite rare in these populations. The International Study of Macronutrients and Blood Pressure, INTERMAP, compared the diets of the US, UK, China, and Japan in detail. See figure 9.1. This study was done in the late 1990s before globalization westernized the Asian diet. Total and percentage carbohydrate intake in China far exceeds the other nations. Sugar intake in China, however, is extremely low compared to the other nations. Japan's carbohydrate intake is similar to that of the UK and the US, but its sugar consumption is far lower. Despite high carbohydrate intakes, obesity rates in China and Japan stayed very low until recently. So, the carbohydrate insulin hypothesis was not incorrect, but clearly something else was going on. Total carbohydrate intake was not the entire story. Sugar seemed to be contributing much more to obesity than other refined carbohydrates. Indeed, many primitive societies that eat mostly carbohydrates have very low obesity rates. In 1989, Dr. Staffan Lindberg studied the residents of Kitawa, one of the Trobriand Islands in Papua New Guinea's archipelago, one of the last places on Earth where people ate a largely traditional diet. Starchy vegetables, including yam, sweet potato, taro, and cassava, made up the basis of their diet. An estimated 69% of calories were derived from carbohydrates, and less than 1% of the calories came from processed Western foods. Despite this high carbohydrate intake, insulin was very low among the Kitavans, resulting in virtually no obesity. Comparing the Kitavans to his native Swedish population, Dr. Lindberg found that despite a diet that was 70% carbohydrate, unrefined, the Kitavans had insulin levels below the 5th percentile of the Swedes. The average Kitavan native had an insulin level lower than 95% of Swedes. The body mass index of young Kitavans averaged 22, normal, and it decreased with age. The possibility that increased exercise led to low insulin levels and less obesity was investigated, but this turned out not to be the case. Similarly, natives of the Japanese island of Okinawa eat a diet that is nearly 85% unrefined carbohydrates. The dietary staple is sweet potato. They eat three times as many green and yellow vegetables, but only 25% of the sugar consumed by residents of nearby Japan. Despite the high intake of carbohydrates, there is virtually no obesity, and the average body mass index is only 20.4. They are one of the longest-lived peoples in the world, with more than triple the rate, compared to nearby Japan, of people living past 100 years. Clearly, the carbohydrate-insulin hypothesis is an incomplete theory, leading many to abandon it rather than to try to reconcile it with the known facts. One possibility is that there is an important difference in eating rice versus wheat. Asians tend to eat rice, whereas Western societies tend to take their carbohydrates as refined wheat and corn products. It is also possible that changes in Western obesity rates are related to changes in the variety of wheat we are eating. Dr. William Davis, author of Wheat Belly, a New York Times bestseller, suggests that the dwarf wheat that we eat today may be far different from the original wheat. The Einkorn variety of wheat has been cultivated since 3300 BC. By the 1960s, as the world's population grew larger, agricultural techniques aimed at increasing the yield of the wheat led to new varieties of wheat called dwarf and semi-dwarf wheat. Currently, 99% of commercially grown wheat is dwarf and semi-dwarf varieties, and it may be that there are health implications of eating these new varieties of wheat. Insulin and obesity are still causally linked. However, it is not at all clear that high carbohydrate intake is always the primary cause of high insulin levels. In Kitawa, high carbohydrate intake did not lead to elevated insulin. The notion that carbohydrates are the only driver of insulin is incorrect. A critical piece of the puzzle had been neglected. Specifically, sugar plays a crucial role in obesity, but how does it fit in? The missing link was insulin resistance. Chapter 10. Insulin resistance. The major player. Oprah Winfrey has waged her weight loss battles publicly for several decades. At her heaviest, she weighed 237 pounds, 107.5 kilograms. By 2005,